So welcome. This is the time series course. And first of all, let's look at the starting instructions. Just a few short overview. So during this course, we will be learning together time series analysis for financial economics. And if you want to pass this course, you have to do an independent home assignment, but you do not have to do necessary that alone. You can do it pairwise, so you're free to choose your partner. I will upload the home assignment instructions soon. So again, this time we will be doing this course using hybrid learning method. That means you'll have to look at the videos on the net, and then we'll go through the demonstrations. But this is the second time we've done this course this way, and first time there was no difference in the results. So same amount of people last time earlier this year were also able to pass this course like during the previous years. So if you're wondering why this method is used here, is because the faculty wants to save money, and this is the cheapest way to do the course, unfortunately. But they want to save the money, and this is the cheapest way this course can be taught. And then I believe this is really a downside, because I believe this is the most important course of your master's program, because during this course you will learn the methods you're needed to do your master's thesis. So that means really take this course seriously. And as this, normally we're teaching this course during the spring term, and now during the autumn term, this means that most likely next time this course we will become available again will be spring 26. So if you need this course, take this seriously. Take this course like it's your last chance to do it. And this course is normally demands more work than other courses. This is you're basically learning how to do statistical analysis, and it will take time to get used to doing it, but I'm here to help you, and I will help you as much as possible. And so in addition to these five demonstration sessions, you will have three online sessions for doing your home assignment. So that means that when you start doing the home assignment and you bump into all kind of problems, there are these certain sessions where you can come to ask help, and I will help you to do the coding. And even though this could sound that this course will be harsh, and most likely you will have to start really grinding, but usually students have been able to do this course, so I believe you're no exceptions. If you just take the time, you will be able to pass this course like everyone else, like 10 to 15 years or so earlier. So you're no exception. You will pass this course for sure. Do you have any questions? And if you want to ask something, just interrupt me. I can be somewhere else in my head, so just interrupt me. It's no offense. So let's start looking. Okay, it was actually over here. Okay. So this week we will have a few analytical exercises and a few computer exercises. So first two are analytical exercises, and then the exercise 4, 5, and 6 is something is for the computer. Third exercise we'll skip because it's basically just to look at the additional material. So the first exercise, validity of the OLS estimation. We are asked which of the following models can be estimated using the OLS. So here, first, can you remember the standard assumptions of the OLS? I'll just write them down here if I can find it. Here. So standard assumptions of the OLS. Remember linearity, that means linearity. The model has to be linear with respect to the parameters. Linearity with respect to the parameters. Second assumption, strict exogeneity. That means, is there a better pencil? Let's stop trying this. Second assumption, strict exogeneity. And what that means, that the error term here has to be independent from the x variable, from the independent variables. So that means that expectation of the error term conditional on the independent variables should be zero. So that means when there's an exogenous shock in the model, it's coming outside from the model. It's not related to these variables. Third, that's the rank condition. Let's just put it this way, rank condition, and what rank condition means, there's no multicollinearity in the model. So basically that means that if there's a multicollinearity in the model, one variable is a sum of the two variables. That's a sum of the multicollinearity. There should not be any multicollinearity. And then fourth, it's related to the error term. There should be no heteroscedasticity and no autocorrelation. So those are the standard assumptions of the OLS. And when we're doing time series analysis, we also have to remember the heterogeneity of the error term, but let's not go into that. So those are our basic assumptions. Then let's start to look at the models. So first model 1.1, we have a really standard OLS estimate, OLS equation. There are no problems. That can be estimated. The second term, we have this a little bit more complex equation. So here, the idea what this the point of this second equation is that the linearity assumption is not that strict as you could think. Why so? Because if you have equation in this form, you can easily make it in the linear form by taking natural logarithms. So using standard rules of the logarithms, the equation will become like this: logarithm of y. And here, as a natural logarithm, and Nepal's numbers are the opposites of each other. They cancel each other out. So that's why you just take the, for example, calculator and press natural logarithm and Nepal's number, you'll get a value of 1. They're the opposites of each other. So taking natural logarithms of the model 1.2, the equation becomes like this. And for sure, it can be estimated. The only difference with the first one is that it's only in log form. What about the third equation? Here the main difference is look at the parameter. So in the first equation, the parameter was beta, and here the parameter is the product of beta and gamma. So basically, there's no difference, only difference between the equation 1.3 and 1.1 is that this parameter has a different name. So you can alternatively, you can put there like a, this name of the parameters could be like George or Henry VIII. You could put those names there, and there's no difference in the equation between the 1.3 and 1.1. So if when the model is estimated, it's just the name of the parameter is just beta gamma instead of beta, nothing else. Fourth equations, that's exactly the same as 1.2, so can be estimated. 1.5. Okay, here we have a interaction term. So the main difference between the 1.5 and 1.1 is that our term is x and z, product of x and z, and not just x. So here, this product of this beta parameter is the parameter estimate for the product of these two variables. So for example, if you have like a Tesla stock could be like the x here, and or rather this way, let's think that y is the changes in Tesla stock, and xt is the S&P 500, and zt is like certain time period. So it's like, it's if you estimated this model, think about it this way, that you have 3 years of observation of the Tesla stocks, but you're interested in estimating it from 1 year, like 2020 and 22, and you have the data for 21, 22, and 23. On the y-axis, you have three years of data, but in the right-hand side, you're only interested to see how the stock price reacts in one period. So think of this z-term like a binary variable, binary indicator that is activated when this 1 year is on. Or alternatively, you could think it this way, that you're interested what COVID-19, what happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. You'll use an indicator dummy that you restrict some time period that is COVID-19 time period, and then you want to estimate the impact of this time period. Okay, then the second exercise, it's the analysis of cap m parameters. So before going to that, little short cap of the history. So can you remember what was the revolutionary idea of the cap m? So instead, the revolutionary idea was that instead of looking at the variability of one stock price, You should look at how this stock price varies with the portfolio. What's the covariability between this stock price and portfolio? So, for example, you think about you have a stock that movement correlates with the main index, but the stock price is going up and down more strongly than the index. So you could, for example, study, should you take the risks investing this more risky stock price instead of index? And usually it is the case that if you invest in singular stock, you're taking unnecessary risk than investing in the index. So index has a lower risk when these both have same expected return. So GAPM, that's about the covariability between the stock returns or returns in general and the general index. So here we have this model, and we've estimated a value of beta tilde is 1 point a little bit more, and then the standard errors are given there. And then there's some analyst saying, salesman is coming and saying, I have this really nice stock, and it's moving similarly to the market, but it has a little bit better return than the market, but there's no extra risk in this stock. So you're thinking about, well, that's a good sales pick, and I'll calculate, should I invest in this one stock or this index? And then you want to test whether what the analyst is saying is true or not. So here, you're interested in testing whether the stock is more risky than the market. So here, first of all, what are the three steps of doing statistical inference, what we're using here? Statistical inference has three different phases. First of all, we'll have to set the hypothesis. Here, the hypothesis is that we're interested. The analyst is saying that stock is moving really close to the market. So that means that the covariability between the stock and the market is one. So here, where did I put my pencil? Let's try some of these. So the covariability, so the beta parameter we're interested in is, by definition, the covariance of the S&P 500 and stock divided by the variability of the sorry, S&P 500. So the analyst is saying that when we standardize the go movement between stock and go movement between the stock and the market, it should be one. So that's something we want to test. They're moving together. And then, as an alternative hypothesis, as we're interested whether this stock is more risky than the market, we're putting that the beta is higher than one. So now we have our hypothesis. Secondly, we have to calculate the test statistics, and by definition, that's the estimated value, so where we have subtracted the hypothesis. So here, 1.147 minus 1, and then we divide it by the standard error of the beta that was also given there, and we'll get the value of 1 point around 1 point 2.7. So third, when we calculate our test statistic to the value of the probability distributor, whether our test statistic is higher or lower than this critical probability value, we'll compare it when we are doing one-sided test. We're comparing to the val this value of wa around 1.7. So as our test t-stat is higher than the critical value of the probability distribution, we reject the null. We find that it is more likely the case that it is more likely that the stock is more risky than the market. Second part, B part. Also, in the B part, we have Nokia shares. And now the analyst is saying that Nokia shares have no systematic risk there. Okay, so beta is zero, meaning that no systematic risk. Covariability between the index and the Nokia share is zero. And then we have these calculated values or bet values. They're given, estimated, the standard errors are given, but we have only 38 observations, so that's quite low number. That means when we have so small sample, this means that we have sampling bias there. So this means sampling bias means that when we're estimating something, we get a value that's approximately corresponds to the reality, but not the reality in itself. So this estimated value becomes with a bias. And that's related to the confidence intervals, and we'll look more that soon. So let's begin this second exercise or B part. So again, three different phases of the statistical inference. First, hypothesis. We need to set our hypothesis. Secondly, we need to calculate our test statistics. And thirdly, we compare our test statistic to the critical value. So first, when the analyst says that there's no systematic risk in the Nokia shares, beta is zero. There's no co-movement between the general index and the Nokia share. And the alternative is that there is systematic risk. Beta is not zero. And then we calculate the test statistics. We take the estimated value, subtract zero is, that is our null hypothesis from it, and divide this by the standard errors. And we get the value of approximately 1.2. Then we calculate our critical value from the probability distribution. So here we have a two-sided table. Alternative is not zero, so we use the both tails of the distribution. And with these degrees of freedom, the value is a little bit over two. So here, as the test statistic is lower than the critical value, that means that there are more evidence that the null stays in power. There's no extra systematic risk or no systematic risk in the Nokia share. So we do not reject the null, but the null stays in power. However, we had quite low number of observations, so there's some bias in our estimate. So we calculate our confidence intervals to get some kind of idea where the true value is. So that using this formula, beta minus the standard errors times the critical value, and plus We can calculate the confidence intervals. So we get the value with 95% of the confidence interval. The true value is somewhere between the minus 0.16 and plus 1.6. So this means, even though we calculated even our sample-based estimate is 1.2, confidence interval gives us a range where the true value likely is. So intuitively think this like this way. There's new Gallup comes for the party support. You look at new Gallup for the party support, and there's party A gets this value and party B get this value and party C get these values. So most likely, if there would be a general election, these values would not hold per se, but the true values would be somewhere close to these values. So for example, if one party has a support of 20%, the true value could be like 19.6. So that's the difference I'm trying to point here. Estimate would be 20, but the true value, if there would be election, would be 90.6. So given that we have this small sample bias here, the true value is somewhere around this estimated value. Yes. A confidence interval formula. Okay, the formula is given here. So sorry about the handwriting here. I can write it down also. So our confidence interval is calculated. You have an estimate for a parameter. Hey. You know the standard errors for the parameter. You take the estimate of the parameters and subtract add and subtract the product of standard errors times the critical value you're interested. So, for example, in our case, the critical value is 'll get the lower bound is 0.5, and then the upper bound is 0.5. So confidence interval means is when you've calculated this range, you can be 95% certain that the true value of beta is somewhere there. That's the confidence interval. So probability is here. Understand in a more abstract sense, something either is or not. So it is about the degree of confidence and not like a 95% confidence in the more common understanding of the probability. Like if I roll a dice, there's a certain probability that some one side will come up. So confidence interval is that the parameter is where we can be this confident that parameter is within this range. And always interrupt me if you want to ask something. Okay, then the computer exercises. I think we'll do the fourth. And then we'll have a break and we'll finish this demonstration session with the 5 and 6. So you should be able to see my R. Let's try if I can. Okay, there seems to be some really strange technical issues here. So what I'm trying to do here, I'm just trying to set my working directory. So the place where the computer should find the data, but it takes so long to find it. Okay, let's do it that another way. So first of all, let's set our working directory. Should be somewhere here. Set working directory. So find the tab session, then set working directory, choose directory. Whether that's there, no. Interesting. Okay, damn. Hopefully my other computer works. There are these really strange issues. Okay, that's locked. Yes, let's use the R software. Really strange. It doesn't change the working directory. Okay. Strong. So sorry about this annoying delay. I've no idea. For example, I'm not even I can't even sign in by using my university's computer. I can't even sign in that. So this is something else. But yeah, let's try to get these demos through, and I'll have just have to try to fix these issues. Okay, now the data. Now I was able to get the data there. Nice. Okay, the first exercise. So let's continue. Fourth exercise, hedge ratios, estimating OLS. So here, someone has a long position in the S&P 500. That means that the investor expects that the price of the S&P will increase. Long position, price will increase in future. However, you never know what will happen in the future, so the investor has taken a short position in the futures contracts. So that means that investors buys S&P 500 now and thinks about selling it later. But in the case that the index will drop, the investors is using this futures contract and selling this S&P 500 at value higher than the expected dropped value. So for example, if the value of the S&P 500 today would be like 100, and the investor thinks about selling it when it's 110, but when in the case that the index drops like to the value of 80 using these futures contracts, investor is able to sell S&P 500 at the value of 100, for example. So futures are here to use to hedge the long position. So we're estimating the beta parameter and so on. So first of all, we'll import the data and do some transformations, divide the sample into whole sample and two subsamples, and then we start to look at the stats. So first of all, how I like to use R is that I like to paint the lines using control and arrows. So when I'm using control and actually it's shift and arrows. So when I have shift and if I press shift and downwards, I'm able to paint it. So using that is more efficient than, for example, yeah, for sure. So I was asked about the possibility of to use Stata. For sure, you can use Stata. I just like to use R because I'm more familiar with it. But if you like to use Stata, no problem. The code should be similar to the R code. So first, before continuing, let's start to interpret how the R is working. So here, for example, we have our data in DF file. So if you want to view it, you can just write view and DF, and it'll show you the data. So here you can glance it. So here in the second part, we're asked to calculate the compounded returns of the spot rates and future rates. So that's the relative changes in these indices. So how this code works is we take the logarithm of a one value, and then we subtract the logarithm of the previous value, log change. Here, the name of the data matrix is DF, so that's the DF, and the dollar sign here specifies the column I want to be specified. Data frame, which column, spot price. That's the name of the second column. And then square brackets here specify the number of observations I'm interested in. So this is from the second observation to the last one. And by default, the R assumes by default that change by default the R adds one there. So that means that, for example, in this way, if I it's really unbelievable. How can it load such simple commands so long? So, for example, if I put one and then column and then it'll specify the values from 1 to 10. If alternatively I'd be interested, like every second value, I'd use this command sequence two to 10 by 2. So this part of the painted code takes the second value of the column second observation and then subtracts the first value from it. And then we'll multiply the result by 100 because we're interested in the percentages. So those are our series. Let's take the futures and spot and futures series. Then we're asked to do the analysis for the whole sample and for two subsamples. So here, why divide the sample into two part subsamples? It's because there's a probability that we have a structural break in the data. That some laws are applying in the first part of the data, but other laws in the second part of the data. And we're using September 2008 as a threshold day. Can you remember what happened in September 2008? That was the pinnacle of the global financial crisis when the Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. So we're studying the data before that and after that. So that's the data. Then let's look at the statistics. So first, summary statistics. There's a minor difference between the median and mean. Mean value is the weighted average of all observations, and the median value is the observation between all the observations. When we order the observations, the median is the value between all. So here, mean being lower than the median, then when we look at the extreme values, the outliers here, the extreme value is -7, 18, and the maximum value is 12. So this gives us an idea that there's some left skewness in the data. Skewness meaning here that the distribution looks like something like distribution is not symmetric, but it's more skewed in one direction. Then a standard deviation of the data is a little bit four. That means that there's a high variability in the data. So standard deviation is the average distance from the mean value. So this standard deviation, this high value means that this data is going up and down really strongly. And most likely the standard deviation is so high because of the outliers here. So it seems that outliers have a huge influence into calculating this standard deviation, as the value of the standard deviation is higher than the third and first quarter of the data. So the value is higher than the 25 and 45% of the data. And then the skewness of the data. We just looked at the summary statistics and got some idea that there's some left skewness. Then we calculated the skewness parameter here, and it's a little bit lower than one. So this means that the data is moderately skewed. If the value would be higher than one, then there's a strong skewness in the data. And kurtosis is about tails of the distribution, so outlier events. So when the distribution has bad tails, example, if the normal distribution would look like this, if the distribution has bad tails, it would look like something like this. Most likely, it has a shovel. So in this distribution, there's stuff happening in the tails. That's extreme economic events. So what could these extreme economic events be? For example, a financial crisis, bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, market crashed after that. Then let's compare the spot value of the S&P 500 to the futures value of the S&P 500. These are the values of the futures. If you compare them to the spot values, they're pretty equal. There are some changes, some differences, but they're pretty equal. More skewness and fatter tails. So our first intuition is that could it be the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers that that's related to the crashing of the markets? And crashing of the markets could be this value of minus 18, this huge outlier event, stock market crashing. So could that be related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers? Let's look at the summary statistic of the first subsample before the bankruptcy and after that. And for sure, just go away. For sure, we can see that the second subsample has this extreme value, so it's most likely related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. So that means that when the Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, stock market crashed. And furthermore, we can see just comparing the minimum values, maximum values, and the means and medians and the quarters that the first subsample is the variability of the data in the first subsample is lower in the first subsample than in the second, and we can also calculate that taking that value. Then so when we calculate just the standard deviation of the first and second subsample, we can see that the standard deviation is higher in the second subsample. There's more variability. And if we compare the same metrics with respect to the future series, would get the same result. Okay, then the fourth part. We're asked to estimate a linear model regressing spots on future changes. So let's run the linear model and interpret it. So what's the interpretation of these parameters? So here, let's just write. This is actually the model we estimated here. This is the spot. And this here is the features. This is the model we estimated. So here, what's the economic meaning of the constant term that is the alpha? So constant term is just something constant in excess of the future's return. So basically, this is the value of the parameter 0.48 is here the value of the variable of ones. So this constant intercept term is nothing else than the value of ones. So it's easier to think the economic meaning of the constant term, for example, when we would be estimating like wages of the people, conditional on the level of their education. So for example, salary is the x-axis, and education would be the sorry, education is the x-axis, and the salary is the y-axis. So constant term is the intercept here, and our estimation would be in some linear perfect world. Our estimation would be something like this. But what about when our content is S&P 500? What's the meaning of the intercept term, the constant term there? So it is about alpha that would be constant excess returns. So given that, first of all, according to the theory, we expect that the value of this parameter is positive. If it would be negative, that would mean that investors are purposefully, intentionally trying to lose money. So it's positive like it should be. And then we find that it is statistically significant at the 10% level. It's weakly statistically significant. So what's the economic interpretation of this term? There is some constant factor in the model that's generating alpha. What is it? We do not know. We have no idea. What about, so in order to understand this better, let's look at the beta parameter, the index. The value is around 0.1, so meaning that if the interpretation is if X day increases 1 unit here, 1%, UT will increase the amount of beta parameter, and that's here 0.1. However, beta is not statistically significant. That means it is not different from the zero. That means this parameter is noise. Not there, there's no statistical power behind estimate. It is not different from zero. Like in the previous exercise, the t stat is calculated like beta value minus our null hypothesis divided by the standard errors of the estimate. And here the value is around 1.6. And that's below the critical value of, let's say, 95%.
Excuse me, Professor.
Yes.
If you're writing on the board is not visible to those students who are participating online.
Okay, sorry, I did not catch you.
I'm asking that if you're writing on the board is not visible to the
Okay.
students who are participating online.
Yeah, so there are only few instances I'm using the board. It is just to help a little bit. Okay, let's. I think I'll. So I'll. Okay, what I was doing here. So let's write it here. I calculated this t statistic. I have this beta value, and I subtracted the null hypothesis there. Like in the previous exercise. Then it was divided by the standard errors of the beta. And the value here is this value. Then I compared this value to the critical value of the probability distribution. And the statistic is lower than the critical value. So this means that the null hypothesis will stay in power. So, okay, I'll start to write this in this way future. I think that's a better option. Thanks for asking clarification. So our result was that the beta parameter highlighted here was not statistically significant, but the alpha parameter was weakly statistically significant. So most likely the case is here that our model is incomplete. We are not able to catch what's happening in the data. So there's something more to be found. So let's save those residuals. Residuals being the y value minus the fitted values. I've saved the residuals from the model. And then let's look at the same from the first subsample. In the first subsample, our result changes from the whole sample. Here, the intercept term is no longer statistically significant, but the beta parameter is statistically significant. So this means that when there's a 1% change in the S&P 500, or excuse me, futures that will the S&P 500 will covariant 0.2 with this change. Let's compare this result to the second subsample. So in the first subsample, we found some statistical significance, but what about the second subsample that's related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers? And there we found the result that the beta term is no longer statistically significant. So when we estimated the whole sample and the first and second subsample, we see that the result changed. So most likely, the statistical significance of the beta alpha parameter here are somehow related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. There's something constant in the data that we're not able to capture. Then in the next part, let's look at the question sheet. The fifth part, we're asked to compare the variance of the spot returns with the variance of the residuals of the hedge ratios we talked about earlier. So here we want to minimize the variability of our data. So here we are asking, are the futures a good hedge for the variability of the spot prices? So let's calculate, that's the variance of the spot, and that's the variance of our hedge ratio. So if we used futures as a hedge for spot returns, our variability would decrease 1%. So that's nothing. It's like if there's a highly moving target, you could decrease its range of movement by 1%. It's basically totally useless. That's not a good hedge. So let's see about whether there's change between subsamples. So how's that in the first subsample? If we calculated the significance of the hedge in the before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, the futures would hedge around 4% of the variability of the spot returns. So that's also like nothing. So when you're taking a hedge, you want to hedge be at least like let's say 50%. That would be a good hedge. If you think about there are two options, stock price can go either up or down, and you want to hedge the downside risk. For the sake of the simplicity, let's just assume that there's a 50% probability that the stock price will go up or down. So that would be a good hedge. And how about in the second subsample after the Lehman bankruptcy? After the Lehman bankruptcy, the hedge ratio becomes even worse. It's like 0.5%, basically. Nothing. So for sure, what this means is that there's no linear connection between the spot and future returns. Most likely, there's something in the data we're not capturing. For example, during the financial crisis, the volatility is for sure higher than what we're assuming in our model. In our model, we are assuming that the volatility remains constant throughout the data even though we have these huge outliers in the data related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. So we should do, maybe we should look at a model that's able to capture the variability of the data better. Then the sixth path, that's about, so earlier we were studying about relative changes. So relative changes are log differences are relative changes. So log x, y, d. It's like the relative change log x minus log. The log difference is like a relative change in the value. Value today means value tomorrow and the change from the yesterday. So that's log changes. So now we're only studying this from the perspective of the prices, not changes. So we're not estimating changes in these indexes, but rather these indices in themselves. Here, the left-hand side of our variable is just the spot price, and the right-hand side is the future price. Let's look at the measure. We get an almost perfect gold movement. So here, the beta parameter here is, by definition, the covariability between the futures and spot prices divided by the standardized or divided by the variability of the futures. So the go movement between these indices is, they're like moving one to one. One indices increases 1% and the other indices follows almost the same. Highly statistically significant. Nothing in alpha, nothing in constant term. So let's plot this. Okay, here the dark line is the spot price and the red line is the future. So you can see that they're like perfectly moving together. Only difference being that the future lags a little bit behind spot prices. Seems that they're highly co-integrated. So let's calculate the variance of the spot prices and the model again. And if we used from the perspective of prices, not changes, let's calculate the decrease in variance if we hedge our spot prices using future. It's almost 100%, like perfect hedge. That's something we want to use as a hedge. If you looked at the data, for example, here, look at my pointer, for example, in this instance, here the future prices starts to decrease a little bit, but the spot prices decreases a little bit, but the future prices lags a little bit behind. So you could use futures as a almost perfect hedge. And same for the subsample, if there's a difference. Okay, let's look at the picture. No, it's only. And when we calculated the same beta for the first subsample, the parameters almost one, almost the same as earlier. So nothing, no change there. That's for the first subsample. Then let's calculate the same beta parameter for the second subsample. Almost one. No difference. And the same pattern applies. Future prices lags a little bit behind the spot price. So in other words, even though we earlier found that the changes or returns in this series are not connected, the levels of this series are connected. In other words, changes are about short term, and our perspective is short term. What happens tomorrow? What's the short term changes in the series? They're not connected. But when we looked at the things at the longer run, how price behaves in the longer run, we found that there's a clear connection in the series. Okay, then the last part of the fourth exercise before a 15-minute break. So that's testing about, that's F tests. So in the first case, we are comparing the restricted model to the unrestricted model. So in the first case, we restrict the parameters of this model. So that means we set the alpha parameter to zero and beta parameter to zero. So here, as earlier, the statistical inference has these three phases. First, we need our hypothesis. Second, we have to calculate our test statistic. Third, we have to compare the test statistic to the critical value of the probability distribution. So first, what are our hypotheses? Alpha is set to zero, beta is set to zero. That's the model one restricted model. And then there is an unrestricted model. And what the F test does is that it compares to the how these models are minimizing the variability in the data. In the first case, the p value is higher than 0.05. That means that our null hypothesis will remain in power. So that means that our restrictions are valid. We do not restrict our restrictions. So that gives us some kind of evidence that alpha and beta parameters are zero. Secondly, let's test whether these coefficients can be restricted to one. The economic meaning being setting the beta coefficient one means that there's a one-to-one co-movement with the data, and setting intercept to one, that's a bit trickier to find an economic interpretation for that there's a constant element in the data, constant excess returns in the data that is go moves perfectly with the data. But let's do that. First phase, what are our null hypothesis? These restrictions. Alpha is one, beta is one. That's the restricted model. Then we looked at the p-value, highly statistically significant below 0.05. That means that it is more probable that these restrictions are not true. That means that we reject the restricted model and think that the unrestricted model works better than the restricted model. However, from this result, we only know that one of these restrictions is valid, not both. So let's do this. Let's restrict only this beta coefficient. If we set a restriction that future prices has a beta coefficient of one moving perfectly together, spot and futures moving perfectly together, that's our restricted model. Then let's look at the p-value below 0.05. We reject the null, meaning when the model one is restricted, unrestricted model minimizes the variability of the data better than the restrictions in the data. So unrestricted model is better. What about the first subsample? Any changes there? First, both parameters to zero. The null stays in power, restricted model is better. Both of these parameters are likely zero. No statistical power there. Let's restrict these parameters to the one. Most likely, the p-value is below 0.05, meaning that the null will not stay in power. Rather, it is more probable that the unrestricted model is better. Then only beta to one, we reject the model. And for the second subsample, both zero stays in power, restrictions are good, restricted model better. The null not stay in power, unrestricted model better. The null not in power, unrestricted model better. So again, statistical inference, three different phases. First you need your hypothesis, what you want to test. You want to test something. You have to write down your hypothesis. Secondly, you have to calculate the test statistic. And third, you have to compare this test statistic to the critical value of the probability distribution. And that's the p-value that'll say whether it's higher or lower to the critical value, the test statistic. So that was the first four exercises. And then let's have a 15-minute break and continue 5 to 2. And again, if you can hear me, whenever you have something to ask, just interrupt me.
Excuse me, Professor.
And by the way, I'm no professor. I'm just teaching here.
Okay. I want to ask a question that
Yes.
why we use restriction in the model? Either the purpose is to for the choice of a better model, that which model is better in explaining the variability.
Exactly. So when we're testing restriction, we're testing which model minimizes the mean squared error in the model. So it's one way to think about which model to use in the estimation.
Okay, from my economic background, when we use any regression model, then our calculation explain the model. Like if the model is, we use our statistics for comparing which model suits the data, explains the data well. Is it the case restrictions are similarly like explaining using our statistics?
So you mean R squared?
Yeah, exactly, R squared.
Yes. So here we're primarily interested in the parameters and not about the overall variability of the data.
Okay,
So
exactly. It is perfect now. I got it now.
Great.
Thank you so much.
And I'll repeat, whenever you have something to ask, just interrupt me, because I just looked at the chat and I missed your earlier question. So please just interrupt me.
Siinä olisi, että näytöstä toteutukselle oli vielä viikko sitten yhtäkkiä se ei ole enää. En vaan laskenut tuolla
siis tässä vaan sanoisin, että pistä heille yhdessä sähköpostiin kysyä asiasta.
Joo.
Mä en osaa, tässä sanotaan näin, että jos Heikki on poistanut, sitten sä kuulet perusteet, miksi poistetaan yksin, miksi ei mahu. Mutta vaihtoehtoinen selitys, että meillä on taas mitä IT on tuossa.
Yeah.
Esimerkiksi mä tuossa hetki sitten, niin katsotaan pystynkö mä uudelleen. Katsotaan, mä pystyn snukkautumaan omaan, niin kuin tuo sanoo, että mun käyttäjätön.
Yeah.
Sitten mun pitäisi töitä pystyä tekemään tästä, että mä pystyn käyttämään tietokoneen.
Kyllä,
Tai
kyllä.
siis toisin sanottuna, että se on kaiken maailman kysy.
Joo, mä laittelin sinne kanssa yksi viesti, mutta niillä ei ole mitään tietoa, että se voi johtua. Mutta joo, tämä tuossa toisella puolella on mun lääkäri, niin kun taas sinne lähtee käymään tietoa taas, että on puolessa.
Joo, ihan vapaasti. Niin kuin sanotaan, että tämä ei ole vaan.
Joo, tämän jälkeen sitten katselen vielä. Ja oliko silleen, että näistä vaikuttaisi niin kuin tallenteet?
Joo,
Joo,
kyllä.
kyllä, se on hyvä.
Joo. Let's continue soon. Maybe we'll wait. There are some people missing. Maybe we'll wait 1 minute and then we'll kick off. Okay, welcome back. And then two more exercises to go. So in the fifth exercise, we're asked to estimate an test gap am. So here we're studying stock data. Yeah, stock data. We're importing data and we're dividing the whole sample into two subsamples, and then we are calculating excess returns and doing some visualization. Okay, there's that. So again, first we need our libraries. How to highlight, use shift plus arrows. Gap-am is our data. That's our data. And then we'll calculate the number of the rows in the data. And then the data. So here again, as a short recap, df is the name of the data. Dollar sign specifies the column we want. Here, for example, city group, and square brackets from the second observations to the last observation. We earlier defined the number of the observations in the data, and that was 239. So from the second observations to the observation 239. And then we take the log differences between them. That's the data. And then we're asked to calculate the excess return. So here, excess return, that's the stock price where we subtract the T-pill. The riskless bond. And then we need two subsamples, and this will do it. Let's look at the data then. So this is the scatter plot for excess returns of the S&P 500 and the excess returns for the Ford share price or changes. So the x-axis will be the changes in S&P 500 and the y-axis the changes in the Ford. There seems to be just a cloud of observations, nothing else. Let's draw a line there to see whether there's a linear correlation. And that's the linear correlation between these two series is basically zero. It seems no linear dependence between the series. Then let's look at the ch Ford changes. So these are the relative changes of the Ford stock price from one period to another. We can see that it's oscillating around the mean value of this zero, so revolving around this constant mean. Let's look at the mean value and so it's oscillating around minus 0.6. Then there seems to be some changes in the variability of the series. Sometimes the variability is higher than others, and then there are these huge outliers that are related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. How about S&P 500? Let's draw that along. Our intuition is that the index is not as volatile as individual share price, the variable changes in the share price, and that's the red line here. So if you compare these two time series, you can see that there's a correlation between them. When the one series is going up, other series is also going up. So they seem to be connected. Let's estimate the model to see whether that's the case. So here on the left-hand side of the equation, we have the excess returns of the Ford, and on the right-hand side, the excess returns of the S&P 500. Okay, let's start interpreting. When there's a 1% change in the S&P excess returns of the S&P 500, the Ford will move around 1.56%. S&P 500 increases 1%, Ford will increase around 1.5%. Highly statistically significant. In addition, we have a bit weird thing here that we have an intercept that is negative, meaning that constant there's a in excess for the beta parameter, there's this alpha parameter that is negative. However, it is not statistically significant. That means there's no difference between this parameter value and the zero. It's noise. In other words, there are no abnormal alpha returns in excess to the market returns. Then, if we think about investing in Ford, let's calculate the Sharpe ratio. What's Sharpe ratio? That's the risk-adjusted return. So this is calculated by taking the mean value of the Ford series and the mean value of the riskless bond T-bill, 3-month T-bill, divided by the standard deviation of the Ford. And the value is almost zero, really lousy Sharpe ratio. So in other words, if you look at this graph and think about, if you ask yourself, can you earn excess returns by investing Ford instead of investing in S&P 500? The answer is no. You're only taking unnecessary extra risk. Of course, the answer is related to the data. Of course, if your invest strategy is like swing trading, of course, if you're really good at timing the market, for example, buying from here and selling from here, you could make fortunes. But swing trading is really difficult. Okay, what about the first subsample? In the whole sample, the beta parameter was statistically significant. First subsample, beta parameter is also statistically significant. It's in fact a little bit higher than earlier. Earlier it was 1.5, now it's 1.6. Statistically significant. What about after the bankruptcy? It falls to 1.5. Yes. However, there's no huge change there, even though the beta parameter falls a little bit. It's relatively robust result, but there's no structural change between the linear dependency between the Ford and the S&P 500. What about the restricting the data testing these parameters? So the next exercise, first we will restrict the excess returns of the 4 to 1. Excess returns of the S&P 500 to 1. So as the beta parameter is covariance between the Ford returns and S&P 500 divided by the variance of the S&P 500. So that's beta, we're restricting that to 1. Testing whether this linear restriction holds, meaning that the Ford and S&P 500 move nicely together. Let's test that. The restricted model is rejected, meaning that unrestricted model is better. Unrestricted model minimizes the residual squared error. So again, going through the statistical inference, remember three phases. First, you need the hypothesis, what you want to test. Second, calculate the test statistic. Third, compare it to the probability distribution. Our null is the restricted model, beta is 1. Then we calculate the test statistic, F test statistic here, and compare to the critical value of the probability distribution. And the test statistic is much higher than the critical value of the probability distribution, meaning that we reject the null. And when the null is restricted, that is the restricted model, it is more likely that the unrestricted model works better. Secondly, let's make two restrictions, alpha and beta, both to 1. Again, we see immediately that the restricted model is rejected, meaning that these linear restrictions restricting alpha and beta to 1 are not good restrictions. Unrestricted model works better. Yes?
And then we higher than the probability, then we check the number.
Yes. So this is the test statistic. And this is the critical value of the probability distribution. If you want to calculate the critical value of the probability distribution, there's a command for it, but I can't just right now remember how it was done. I'll have to check that one, but this is the value of your test statistic, you calculate it, and the value of the probability distribution, the critical value comes from the theory or from the table, so to say. And this p value is the corresponding critical value for the probability distribution that correspond to this F test statistic. Was I able to answer your question?
So p value is really small.
Yes. The p value here is like It's something like this. Really, really small p value. Now, exactly. So 0.05 is the critical threshold value, the threshold value for the p. If the p value of the test statistics is smaller than the 0.05, we reject the null. That was for the entire sample. Then the first subsample, this is before the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. Again, we are restricting the beta as one. In other words, the four excess returns of Ford and the S&P 500 move perfectly together. Okay, before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, the p-value is not that small as in the whole sample. Nevertheless, this p-value is smaller than the 0.05, and when this is the case, we reject the null hypothesis. Here, our null hypothesis is that the beta parameter of the linear model is restricted to the one. That was our linear restriction. And we reject these restrictions. In other words, the unrestricted model works better. Then let's restrict both the intercept and beta, alpha and beta. Okay, we added another restriction to the model, and the p-value is restricted more firmly. So earlier we restricted the null on the level of 0.02. Now at the level of 0.002. So when we added another restriction, the restricted model became even worse.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Sidra here. I want to ask a question that we include various restriction setting variables, restriction setting a model equal to 1, equal to 2, equal to 0. What do these numbers imply?
So you mean the value of 1?
Yes, value of 1, okay. Value of 0, and value of 2. What these numbers imply?
Okay. So what we are restricting, our beta variable or beta parameter is by definition this. So this is our restriction. So there's a covariance. That's in other words, the co-movement between two variables. So co-movement between the Ford returns, excess returns, and the cove movement between S&P 500. So when I make a restriction, and then this is standardized by the variance of the S&P 500. But here the important part is the cove movement between two variants. We have these two variables, and we are restricting them to one. That means that the co-movement between these two variables is equal. When the one is going up, other follows perfectly. You got the point?
Yeah, I got it.
Great.
Thank you.
So that's the beta. I can also write down what this means in the terms of the intercept, alpha or intercept. Here it is about the covariance, co-movement between one or unity. That's the variable of the alpha and the forward returns divided by the variability of the one. That's of course equal to one. That's the same thing also in the case of the intercept term, like with the beta term. So here, when we added this additional restriction, the restricted model, the result was even worse than in the earlier case. So this means that when we are restricting the both parameters to the one, it is more likely the case that this model is wrong than in the case that when we restrict only one parameter to one. In other words, linear restrictions do not work. Then let's look at the second subsample after the Lehman bankruptcy. Here we are restricting the beta parameter, that is the co-movement between the Ford excess returns and S&P 500 after the Lehman bankruptcy to one. That's the restricted model. Let's look at the p-value. Below 0.05, we reject the restricted model. Unrestricted model where there are no restriction that beta is one is a better model than the restricted model. And the same applies also if we add another restriction to the model. So what this means is that Ford is riskier stock than the S&P 500, or if there's some practical implication of this, you're more likely making better returns just by investing in the S&P 500 than the Ford stock, even though you can see from this graph that the Ford stock price is going up and down more strongly. So if you would invest in the Ford stock price, Ford instead of index, you would just take additional unnecessary risk. Then the last exercise, the exercise number six. Actually, we already did the first part of the six exercise that was we did the F test for the earlier model. So in the B part of the sixth exercise, we are analyzing an APT model, arbitrage pricing model or theory. So this is an extended version of the CAPM. First, the data. Then again, I want to calculate the number of the rows or the number of the variables I have in data because I need this N values in specifying the rows of the data. Then the data. If you want to, I can read this R code again. Do you find, would it be helpful? Or shall we just continue? So short recap, df is the name of the data. I have these variables. This is the df, the data I have, multiple series. Dollar sign specifies the column I want. For example, if I want to take this Microsoft column here, I'll just write dollar sign Microsoft, and then I'll take this series from the second observation to the last observation. And this colon sign auto implicitly implies that there's a unit change in these values. In other words, if I write two from two to n, it would print all the values here. Okay, so this data has, over 400 observations, some even some missing values. Well, those missing values are no problem. So that's our data. Let's look at the exercise sheet. There's no model there. So what we're estimating next is our left-hand side. Left-hand side is the Microsoft changes in Microsoft share price. And our right-hand side is the constant term, and then beta 1 is S&P 500. Then we have, in addition, consumer price index there, changes in the consumer price, monthly changes. Then, thirdly, changes in the productivity. Fourth, we have the M1 money supply changes. For then we have the changes in interest rate spread, and then fourth we have changes in the consumer credit. So those are the all variables on the right-hand side. Let's run the model and look at the statistics. So we have a lot of macro variables on the right-hand side, and we're interested whether they can predict the changes in the Microsoft share price. Most likely, there is no correlation. And here, just by looking at the result, we see S&P 500 is statistically significant, and then there's some statistical significance with the changes in the consumer credit. So this second one is a bit interesting. This can be pure noise, or so even this can be false. In other words, this can also be false positive. Even though it's statistically significant, the true value is not statistically significant. Okay, startup doesn't find significant. Okay, so then the here, the interpretation of the S&P 500 is that when there's 1% change in S&P 500, the Microsoft changes move 1.16. But then let's test whether what happens if we restrict. So according to this result, we find that S&P 500 is the most significant factor moving the Microsoft changes, Microsoft share price changes in the Microsoft share. Then in addition, let's restrict our model by setting all these other variables to zero, meaning that they are statistically, their noise irrelevant. So that's our restricted model. So again, three phases of the statistical inference. First, we need our hypothesis. Secondly, we calculate the test statistic here, the F-test statistic. And third, we compare this value of the test statistic to the critical value of the probability distribution, and it will give us this p-value. These parameters are set to zero. P-value is much higher than 0.05, meaning that the null stays in power, and when the null stays in power, restricted model is better than the unrestricted model. So in other words, if we threw all these variables away and estimated our Microsoft shares just by S&P 500, we should get the same result as earlier. We threw five variables away from the model, and with these variables, the value of the beta S&P 500 was 1.16. And when we threw the unnecessary variables away, the result stays the same. However, the intercept has become statistically significant. Okay, that's an in okay, it was earlier statistically also significant. So here, the intercept alpha means that there are some potential excess return in addition to the S&P 500 in the Microsoft share price. Please, just ask Citra. So this was this exercise, and you can ask any question you want to now.
I'm asking that we haven't incorporated residual in the model, in any model. What is the objective of not including residual term?
So basically, all of these models, in fact, do include the residuals, but we have not studied the statistical properties of these residuals. So basically, what we should do next, for example, because we have not studied the residuals, we, for example, have no idea whether this model is valid. For example, it could be well be the case that there's some autocorrelation in the residual. It could also be the case that there's some. It could also be the case that there's some omitted variables. The residual is there's something there's. Omitted variable included in the residuals, and when that's the case, the strict exogeneity property of the OLS does not hold. For example, here, the expected value of the error term conditional on the x variables is not zero. So for sure, we should continue our analysis by studying the properties of the residuals, but that was not our goal today. But nevertheless, that's a great question, and that's something you should think about. Is the residual valid? Okay, that's all, folks. So have a nice week, and we'll